This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, of Good and Evil, depictions of morality in speculative fiction.
Now, in previous weeks, we suggested you watch Good Omens, so this episode is going to proceed with the understanding that you've gone and done that.
Yeah, so if not, admittedly the book has been out for a good 20 years now, so if you somehow missed the ending and you're worried about being spoilified, then perhaps skip this episode for now. Before we really get into it, I'm going to do a very, very brief 101 philosophy, morality and ethics type introduction, shall we say.
So everybody, if you could sit down, get out your pens and paper and prepare to take note.
I promise this is relevant. This isn't me just going randomly off on a tangent because it happens to interest me as I have done so often in the past.
You know what? That's what our listeners are here for. So go ahead, Jules.
Okay. Right. Well, there's morality and there's ethics. And philosophers generally use those terms interchangeably. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And certainly the further back in history you read, the more you'll find philosophers who are talking about ethics will actually use the terms interchangeably. With me so far?
Yes, I'm
okay. Okay. Well, it's more sort of for everybody at home, but I wasn't really expecting an answer. Okay, so if we, but in a more modern sense, you find that more modern philosophers tend to divide the two. So ethics, the general accepted definition is, if there is a distinction being made between ethics and morality, ethics is considered a standard of right and wrong or good and bad imposed by some outside group, society, or profession. Morality, on the other hand, is one's own personal sense of right and wrong and the code of behaviour you impose upon yourself.
Right, okay.
So those are the two things. Now, the reason I brought this up is because some of the great works of, I say great works of literature, great works of speculative fiction and literature as well, and obviously TV series and things, when they get into the realms of ethics and morality, what often drives the plot is the contradiction between the two. So let's say that you have a society, let's say that you personally believe in freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. That's your personal moral standpoint. You believe people should be free to speak and should not have their freedoms in that area curtailed as long as they're not saying inducing hatred. But you live in a very, very secular society that believes you should not be able to make images of religious leaders, for example. So it's that the ethics of the system is impinging on your moral outlook. So what drives a plot in something like that is the conflict between the ethics that are being imposed on you by the society and the morality, your own personal code, if you like. So this really is relevant when we get to Good Omens in a minute. Okay, and then you have people who, you have some philosophers who are very much sort of ethics, as in the morality basically imposed by the system, but the ethical standards, they're everything. Anything else outside of that just, you know, it doesn't count. It's not part of that particular system. This is known as relativism. And then you have people who think that the only thing that matters when it comes to good and bad, right and wrong, is your own moral standpoint. And that tends to be called emotivism.
Yeah.
Good Omens has managed to touch on all of these things. And I think a lot of people have kind of missed the point. You don't obviously have to have a basic understanding of moral philosophy to really follow the plot, because believe it or not, you encounter moral philosophy every day in your day-to-day life. making choices about what you eat, making choices whether to recycle something, making choices whether to strictly adhere to the law. Obviously, don't tell me if you haven't, but, you know, strictly adhere to the law, even when the law's not right on something, because the law does fail people.
Yeah, it does. And I think that there's no greater demonstration of that than the fact that, well, we have demonstrations for a reason.
Yes.
And I think for the most part that human beings are usually quite utilitarian, and that's kind of how democracy works. But utilitarianism, if we, let's go by John Mill, let's go by John Mill's utilitarianism, which is that you still follow kind of the basic laws, but laws are basically put together on the understanding that they benefit the net happiness of everyone, basically, yeah, in the society. And that happiness is what qualifies as morality. So something which makes the largest amount of people happy is thereby the right thing to do. But it's not just the largest amount of people that's happy, it's about the quality of happiness. So, for instance, there might be a large amount of people who say, ah, we want to kill these other people, but there's a smaller amount of them, but that doesn't necessarily make them right, because actually the happiness they gain from killing them doesn't actually trump the happiness of these people for not being killed. So it's quite complicated. There's no real scale that we can kind of evaluate it by. And that's kind of how democracy sort of works, in that we put down the things which we are happy or that we think we can kind of discuss it, and we put it to the people as much as possible. So for the most part, people are quite utilitarian, but it works in the day-to-day, but on the grander scale, in terms of morality, it's a little bit more complicated. And that's when you get Kako coming forward, just saying, no, it's all about them laws.
Yeah, precisely.
But yeah, they definitely touch on all of those in Good Omens.
And not to pick on America, for example, but very recently a law was passed in Alabama stating that women could not get abortions. And it wasn't just a case of, oh, we don't think you can willfully get rid of a developing life just because you don't want a baby. It was a case of, no, even if it's been imposed upon you, by the fact that we won't teach about birth control, we won't allow you to get birth control, we won't allow you to have a tubal ligation without your husband's permission. If you happen to be raped, all of these things, basically what that law is doing is reducing women down to the role of baby maker, which is appalling when you consider what century we live in and what year we live in. So technically, the ethics of Alabama state that is what you should be following. But a lot of people's moral feeling on the subject is that law is incorrect, to say the least.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's one very, very big conflict, which, you know, we can't really get into the ins and outs of the law itself, and probably it'd be better not to, because I start to foam at the mouth slightly when I do.
Yeah. I feel not great already, just thinking about it. Very, a huge number of feelings regarding this particular topic.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So having looked at morality and ethics in the philosophical sense and the conflict between the two, we're just going to do a little segue into something a bit more light and fun, and that is looking at the Dungeons and Dragons alignment of morality, goodness, and neutrality. and I'm gonna hand it over to Madeline, because she knows a bit more about this than I do.
Yeah, okay, so this chart, the alignment chart, is used in D&D games, but has become a bit of a meme, really, to be honest. You see a lot of people using it for jokes and placing characters from TV shows or even books into that chart. And I'm not going to lie, I've done the same. It is quite fun. So basically, it's nine categories, and it's made up of lawful, neutral, and chaotic, and then good, evil, So we're just going to go very quickly through each category, and yeah, hopefully you stay with us. So the first one, starting from the top left-hand corner, is lawful good. Now, lawful good, we should just basically have it explained. Lawful means you operate within a system of not necessarily a legal system, but it's a legal system. So it's a system of morality, a code with which you will not break. You cannot break.
Going back to our definitions of morality and ethics, lawful would suggest that you work within a system imposed by an outside influence.
Yes. Neutral means that you tend to mostly work within that system, but you're not completely restrained by it. So you are relatively happy to kind of break it if the need arises. And then chaotic is you don't work within that system at all, whatever the system is. All right. So lawful good, it is this character who is, they're a good character, but they function within that system. So a good example might be He-Man, for instance.
Yeah, definitely.
So He-Man here, we have someone who is operating within those set parameters, and they are continuously rewarded for just being good. So they, you know, it's not just something they do unwillingly. It is usually part of their whole kind of ethos as well. They are the good guys. And you will tend to see lawful good kind of characters might be someone who is working in like the police. I'm talking about characters. Someone, a lot of like kind of Disney princes as well. There's a lot of lawful good there as well. They're working within set parameters. Okay. Next one along is neutral good. Now, neutral good is someone who is mostly law abiding, but isn't against the idea of kind of dipping their toe out of the line if it suits them. And the thing is that when you are good, so either lawful good, neutral good, or chaotic good, that basically means your ambition is to do good. You are a good person, you are trying to do the right kind of thing. So in your pursuit of trying to do the right kind of thing, a neutral good person would mostly stick within the law, but they'll also go outside of the law if they believe it will create, it's for a good cause.
Yeah, I think it's a position of loyalty as well, isn't it? If you think about it, obviously the good refers to your morality, and lawful refers to the ethics of the system. And if you're lawful good, then that tends to be a case of your morality is aligned towards being good, but also you are loyal to the ethics of the system, and maybe to the point where you can't even see that there are flaws within the system. Whereas a neutral good person isn't necessarily married to the ethics of the system, and yes, they, as you say, they are law-abiding generally, but they are inherently aware of the flaws in the system and where it fails people.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically like, are you a bureaucrat or not? Sorry, that was a tasteless joke. Okay, so the final one in the good alignment is chaotic good. Now, chaotic good tends to be what the alignment that we see in a lot of popular characters, books and things like that. You know, it could be argued that the chaotic good is someone who is doing the right thing, but is completely happy to work outside of the law to do that. So an example of chaotic good would be Robin Hood, for instance.
Han Solo or Mal Reynolds, or basically the space cowboy trope that I like so much.
Yeah. and I love the term chaotic good, because it's just chaos. You adding chaos to anything instantly makes it kind of funny, and I just imagine someone who kind of comes in like a whirlwind, and then when they leave, everyone's like, oh, everything's a little bit better. Yeah. I mean, it was terrible while they were here, but actually they've done good.
It's no inherent loyalty to the ethics of the system. They might well operate within the system, but that's because it's convenient to them rather than because they actually feel any loyalty towards the imposed ethics of a system or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so next on the line we have neutral. Now, the concept of neutral is, well, as it implies, you're not really kind of, you're not really a good person, so you're not out to do good things, but you're not really out to do bad things. You kind of live in the middle. And the sort of the neutral zone is where you tend to find reluctant heroes, or even anti-heroes as well. As the chaotic good, you'll find them in the kind of the neutral area. So once again, you have the lawful neutral. So that's someone who operates within the legal system, and they're not doing it because they think it's right, and they're not doing it because they have nefarious reasons and they know that it's evil. They just do it. That's just the structure that they follow, and they will follow it to the letter.
Yeah.
Okay, then you have true neutral. Now, true neutral is a really, really interesting one, and I think would certainly make a very interesting character. And I'm trying to think of examples of sort of true neutral. True neutral is just the complete center, literally of the chart, literally of the entire alignment. You are not married to the legal system. You are not married to goodness, you are not married to evil, you are not married to chaos. You just exist.
I think, yeah, this is part of a weird conversation I had with Alan the other night, and he was trying to persuade me that I was lawful good, and I'm like, I'm really, really not. I'm like, I'm far more over towards chaotic good. And he's like, no, there's no way you're Han Solo. And he said, okay, so what am I then? I said, you're true neutral. And he sat there for 5 minutes. And then he came back with, you're right, I am. And it's not a case of just sort of sitting there existing. It's a case of your allegiance does not belong to anybody except yourself. And you may choose to be a decent person, which, you know, in fairness, Alan does. He is generally a decent person, and he's generally law abiding. But at the same time, he doesn't actually have an allegiance to being any of those particular things. And I suppose you could argue that that's the sort of mental freedom that very, very few people ever attain. You could also argue that that's the sort of place where all the sociopaths live as well.
Well, the way I see it is that it is the place of the complete of the innocent, in that there's nothing, as you say, there's no you're not tied to anything. So babies are true neutral, as far as I'm concerned. Children are true neutral. So I think you're onto something in terms of the sociopath kind of thing. But actually, I think a lot of people are true neutral when they're kind of going through their lives. And I think it is the difference between, you know, this alignment chart doesn't really work in terms of real life, unless you've got a particular kind of a passion or a thing or you know, a philosophy that is very prominent in your mind. I think a lot of people, for most of the part, are true neutral. Maybe going a little bit one way, maybe going a little bit the other way. But yeah, it's an interesting one. So then you have chaotic neutral.
Which sounds like it shouldn't be possible, doesn't it?
It does sound like it shouldn't be possible. And yet again, that this is a really, really interesting one. And you know who I think of chaotic neutral? And we're going to be talking a little bit more about this, so, but I kind of feel like chaotic neutral is Crowley from Good Omens.
Yeah, we'll definitely come back to that. I think possibly. This is basically what you're getting so far in this podcast is the foundation for our arguments for Good Omens and other things in a minute. So we will get back to it. But yeah, I think you're right. But it's kind of, to me, that a chaotic neutral person is kind of, it's the universe's untidy people in a way, as in they sort of crash on through and you kind of need them. They're like forest fires or natural disasters, and they renew the land, but at the same time they're not very pleasant when they're actually happening.
Okay, so then finally you have the evil sector. Now, the evil sector, you know each of these villain characters. Okay, so first you have the lawful evil.
I've always said lawful bad, because evil's quite a very specific term. And
okay, all right. So we'll say bad then. Okay, so lawful bad. Now, the lawful bad character is the person who exists within their own, within that system. Now, it may not actually necessarily be an imposed system. It might be their own system. So they might say, I will never, you might have a hitman who will never kill a child, for instance.
Or,
Says that, that's just a.
someone like the Kingpin.
Exactly. Who have a system, they kind of follow it to the letter, they have a code, and they will abide by it. Even if it ultimately causes them bigger problems, they'll abide by it.
Yeah, and you'd find sort of your white collar criminals here as well. You know, the really, really high up ones, in the sense of, oh, well, yeah, okay, I doing this is going to crash the stock market, but I'm taking away £66 million, so it's kind of okay.
Yeah.
And I won't get
Okay.
caught because I'm working within the system.
Yeah. You then have neutral evil. So again, when we discuss that neutral territory, neutral evil is that you are not good or bad, you're basically out there for yourself. And or rather, sorry, when I say neutral evil, you're not lawful or chaotic, you're just out there for yourself. You will most Unless it doesn't, it isn't convenient for you, in which case you will break it.
Yeah, in a way, I find the idea of a lawful, sorry, not lawful, a neutral bad person is actually probably more dangerous because there's no real passion there to appeal to. There's nothing you can get a handle on to twist them one way or another. They are
Yeah.
literally sort of in the middle, quite self-involved, to the point where they're like the really bad end of the sociopath scale, whereby the only person who's really real is them.
Yeah.
So, or you
Yeah.
know, perhaps one or two others. And I suppose I would think of people like, you know, Hayes from I Belong to the Earth. It's a case of, no, you really genuinely only think you and one other person is real and everyone else can sort of die.
Exactly, yeah. And then finally, you have chaotic evil, or chaotic bad, really, we should say. So chaotic bad is exactly as it's someone who completely disregards all of the systems that are put in place, all of the rules, and just does what they want. Examples of this, interestingly enough, the chaotic kind of evil again has this element of innocence to it, because when I say innocence, I don't mean innocence as in goodness innocence, as in it doesn't really have any other kind of agenda, if that makes sense. It is just. Or it can sometimes not have an agenda. So, for instance, you could have zombies. You could probably put them in chaotic evil.
I'd put Thanos there
I put Thanos there as well. But
because he's
then, yeah,
nihilistic
Thanos.
and
True, but then Thanos does have his own kind of set of rules that he does follow, even if they're not the rules that everybody else wants.
yeah, but the system isn't being imposed by the outside, so you can't argue that it's a set of ethics being imposed by a system. It's with it that that would come under the morality scale. So technically he would be chaotic evil because his nihilism is leading him to believe that it's giving him a massive god complex and leading him to like destroy half of everything because he thinks that's how you balance it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm willing to concede that. But yeah, so the chaotic evil character, you do kind of know what you're getting with that. And they will just decimate, and destroy, and it doesn't really matter at all, basically. So there we go. That is the alignment chart. It's great fun to play around with it. So if you were ever playing with your characters, I think for the most part, a lot of popular characters go into the chaotic good area.
Where would you put yourself?
Where would I put myself? Oh goodness. I mean probably neutral good, to be honest. I'd like to say chaotic good. I'm not really out there robbing the rich and feeding the poor. I kind of guess that sort of I work with a neutral good because I do work within the law, but I do push against things which I feel to be unjust, because I don't think the law is what's the word? The final word. But oh goodness me, what's the word there? When something is infallible. There we go. I don't think the law is infallible. So Yeah, that's probably where I'd go. I'd put Kestrel in chaotic good.
Yeah.
I'd put Rufus in neutral good and then steadily becoming more chaotic as
See,
time
I would have
goes
put him in
on.
chaotic good, but I'm obviously going from Blood of Delphi.
Yeah, like book one, he's also like dumpty dumpty dum, the way the laws work is right, and then it kind of goes there. Whereas with Zachary, he's lawful good, and then he kind of slips into neutral good and then slowly into chaotic good.
Yeah, it's like Amy is chaotic good because she's, you know, it's a case of, well, I respect that we need to have laws for everybody, but I don't think they necessarily apply to me if I need to do something. But all
it
just
is
the
good
best of
fun.
intention. It is really fun, and it's a great way of thinking about, you know, as a writer, thinking about your characters, where would they fit? Because ultimately, nobody is any one thing off that particular chart. They're different
No,
things at different parts of their lives, and it all bleeds into each other. Anybody who is ever just one thing is really, really dangerous, and you probably need to stay away from them.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is that, yeah, different circumstances can make you change. I mean, we talked about our favorite tropes, you know, you can be lawful good, suddenly go, hang on a second, the law is failing people.
Yeah,
and then
I'm working for the bad guys.
Yeah.
I thought I was the good
guys?
Guy. We've got skulls on our helmets. Sorry. Oh, off we go again. Another thing that I think is really worth mentioning, very, very few characters ever really fall into the chaotic bad side of the scale. Just because they're really difficult to write, for one thing. How do you make somebody who has very little motivation other than sheer nihilism and destruction a believable prospect? And it's incredibly difficult. And you could argue the same of lawful good, although that's easier to write because it's a case of, well, you have this whole system and it's always been telling you this is right, this is good, etc., etc. So really all you're doing is writing a character who's an extension of the system. I would like to point out that both chaotic evil, sorry, not chaotic evil, chaotic bad and lawful good are as damaging as each other. There is something very terrible about goodness that never questions itself, just as terrible as there is about something that is so chaotically bad that it will destroy anything it touches. So that's an interesting thing to think about, and that will, in a moment, bring us on to Paradise Lost.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, you know, you mentioned that Thanos is chaotic evil, because I guess I never really thought of the difference between lawful and chaotic being that there was something coming from a morality being just from the outside. I used to think that it could also be a morality which is also self-imposed, but this morality which is self-imposed might have come from, you know, the way that you were raised, or you know, just the general impression you have, and that even if that morality inconveniences you, you have to follow it. But regardless of, I think I do concede, I think you're probably right that it does kind of have to come from the outside, but it has to be imposed from the outside. But interestingly enough, means is that if you have Thanos, who is chaotic evil, everyone who works under him is lawful evil.
Yeah. Yeah, they're lawful bad because they are accepting his system of ethics as the one that is correct. And there is a sense of relativism there because they are saying that the ethics that he has imposed are all.
Yeah.
So that there you go. I think what we're really getting at here is that in terms of philosophy and morality and ethics, anything that is absolute is a really, really bad prospect. And you need all the different shades in between.
Yeah. But
that was supposed to be the light segment of this podcast, and in the end it got really heavy. Let's talk about, before we go on to Good Omens, we really are going to do Good Omens. I know we keep dangling it in front of you guys and then smashing it away. Let's just talk about Paradise Lost, because Paradise Lost supplied a lot of inspiration for Good Omens.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure everybody is familiar, at least with the concept of John Milton's epically, epically long poem written in the 1600s regarding the beginning of mankind in the Garden of Eden and the war in heaven between the one sector, one faction of angels and the other faction of angels. Yes. And what it basically comes down to, you had the five archangels and you had God, and God created man, and God said, look what I've created, isn't it awesome? You must all bow down and worship it. And four of the archangels went, well, okay, I guess. And the most beautiful archangel of all, Lucifer, said, no way, I'm not, what are you talking about? We've accepted you as God, we've accepted you as our divine creator, and now you want us to bow down to one of your creations. It's not even a mortal, what are you talking about? It caused a huge schism in heaven. And you'll notice I'm saying between different factions of angels that, you know, there's the adversary side, made up of Lucifer and all the angels who are behind him, and God's side with all the angels behind him. There weren't any real demons involved, I'd like to point out. That came much, much later.
Yeah.
obviously, the rebel angels were defeated and they were flung down into the pit, which may have been Earth, may have been slightly lower than Earth, or may have been where all the fairies were banished to. You know, the jury is out. And Michael, one of the other archangels, was left to guard the pit. And there's various other bits and pieces in there. What's really interesting about Paradise Lost, in fact, there's several things that are really interesting about it, but from the perspective of this podcast, what's interesting about Paradise Lost is the fact that the way John Milton writes it, and most of it was dictated through his daughter Deborah, because he was almost completely blind by the time he wrote it. So either he or she had an awful lot of sympathy for the devil, if you like. So they had a lot of sympathy for Lucifer and the rebel angels. And it's written in a way where you can really kind of see Lucifer's point. And you're kind of left feeling that all the way to the end of the poem. It's not a morality tale. And it obviously attracted a lot of church criticism at the time, because it wasn't out and out, the devil is bad.
Yeah, it was the birth of sexy Satan as well.
Yes. Well, we don't know that. He might have been a sexy guy anyway. But... or a girl, we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, it is. Paradise Lost was interesting because it did actually give this point of saying, actually, you can sort of understand Lucifer's point, Lucifer turning around and saying, hold on a second. I'm not bowing down before, I'm bowing down to you. You are the highest thing of all. And God being like, no, you must bow before them. but also, interestingly enough, it kind of was the first major bit of artwork about the Abrahamic kind of mythos, which touched on sort of much older texts and ideas regarding the positions of angels and actually what being a fallen angel actually meant.
Yeah. Okay. So you're thinking about things like the Kabbalah, for example, which is an immensely complicated is a Judaic system of, I suppose, self-actualization on one level, but also it contains a lot of the mythos and the lore, and in my opinion, it's not something necessarily to mess around with, but it's something very interesting to study. You'll notice that if you delve into Aramaic and Hebrew and Judaic mythology, that there is an angel for everything. I've mentioned before that there is an angel for sacred prostitution, that there's an angel for what essentially amounts to BDSM and various other things like that. It really is interesting. And if you look at angels in the sense of they kind of personify archetypes, aspects of the human personality. So when I talk about the whole it being part of the self-actualization, that's kind of where I'm going from. If you're looking at it in the sense of fallen angels who weren't really demons in all honesty, then the battleground then shifts. The battleground is no longer the higher planes of the mind. The battleground is something completely different. And it's been basically the war is being waged the whole time, according to mythology, between the fallen angels and the angels of heaven. And the battleground is Earth. And the battleground is the human soul. And that has really, really captured the imagination for lots and lots of people, particularly horror writers, but people who like mythology, who delve into various other things, and mm-hmm. especially science fiction and fantasy writers, which I think is a good segue into Good Omens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of those interesting things about Paradise Lost, which you then get onto in Good Omens, is the introduction of that grey quality, which the church didn't like, and which basically, that's me summarising exactly what you've just said. It was about that grey quality, and about the idea that the battleground Earth was that grey quality, and that's where it all exists.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing then isn't that grey quality is humans, it's that it is Earth itself, and that maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Yeah. Just as a complete sidebar, I'm sure I've mentioned this book before, it's called The Magus of Strophilus, and it's by Kyriakos Makaidis. And there's a really, really interesting, it basically is about an Orthodox Christian mystic. Really interesting series of books. Not sure how much of it I believe, but I'm being open-minded. But he talks in one, the teacher at one point talks about a man who was reckoned to be a great spiritual leader, and he was there present when this man was about to die. And all through his life, this man had been preaching about how you need to live a blameless life, and therefore you can ascend. And he wasn't talking about ascending into heaven. He was talking about you can ascend to your higher self. You can become something more. So you can actually become the best, if you like, the best version of yourself, a creature of pure spirit. So all through his life, this is what the guy had been teaching. And then on his deathbed, what his disciples gathered round to hear his last words of wisdom from a man who was as close to God as you can get while you're still inhabiting flesh. And the teacher mm-hmm. said, I want to live. My God, I want to live. Because to be human, to be enveloped in flesh like this, to be given this opportunity, is to be divine. And I think, I know that's a really random little story to bring up, but it makes me think of Good Omens, because the premise of Good Omens is that you have Crawley, who was the snake in the garden, who changes his name because Crawley's just not very cool, really. And you have Aziraphale, who was supposed to guard the gates of the garden with his fiery sword. And they both do their jobs, but they end up striking up the beginnings of a very, very unlikely friendship, which leads in them both being banished to Earth to continue with various projects. They're supposed to be representing either the God and his angels on one side, or Lucifer and the fallen angels, the demons of the pit, on the other side. And neither of them is really completely sold on their cause, but they have thousands and thousands of years to work on the fact that they're kind of both moving towards the neutral position on the D&D chart.
They really are, yeah. And in doing so, they basically become human.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously still have powers, and their tech, they can discorporate and shapeshift, and there's various other things. They're not like gods or anything, but at the same time, they understand the human perspective in a way that the ultra, if you like, the ultra lawful good and the ultra chaotic evil cannot possibly ever get their minds around. And the argument in Good Omens is that both of these sides are as bad as each other, because what they want to do is destroy the one really good thing that's accidentally been created in the middle.
Yeah. With, and this is the interesting thing, though, because the whole concept of Good Omens is that, you know, the Christian mythos is all true. The world was created and in 7 days, Adam and Eve was a thing, and that Lucifer fell because he refused to bow down to human beings. And now, basically, they think the plan is to destroy human beings in a great battle.
Yes, it's the Book of Revelations, basically, which, if you've ever read that, that's a really cheery read, definitely. Lots and lots of fun. If you can understand one word in five, bravo. Although if you can understand one word in five without resorting to the Persia format, because then it does kind of make sense, but not in a way that you actually want it to. Put it this way, he's talking about it's St. John the Divine allegedly wrote it while he was banished to Patmos, and my theory is that he didn't get a lot of water to drink, but so what he was writing was, have you ever noticed how often God chooses madmen to be his prophets? It's a serious biblical thing. Apparently they're supposed to not twist the message as much as someone else would, which I find a really interesting idea, but we've moved away from Good Omens. So, Good Omens does, as you say, go from the position of, let's assume that the Book of Genesis was correct and everything else that happened in between, you know, it's all unfortunate, but all of it is basically symptomatic of this great war between good and bad that has been going on for millennia. And humans are the battleground over which the war is being fought. And it's just wonderful that you have an angel and a fallen angel or demon who are kind of put in the position of, well, we actually like Earth. There's all this great stuff here. There's crepes, there's Queen, there's classic cars, there's tweed suits and bookshops. And why are we destroying this again? And it's everything you want, where you have the two most unlikely allies teaming up in order to prevent the end of the world, and incidentally going against the ethical systems of both sides.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about them is that they're teaming up to prevent the destruction of the world, but they still are kind of operating within the lanes that they pre-exist in. What they don't realise is that they're speeding towards each other.
On occasion, of course.
Wind up in the middle.
They are. Now, talking, obviously, we've sort of touched on the book a little bit just through talking about it. I really liked the way they adapted the book in general. There are a few things that didn't work for me quite as well, but the whole Aziraphale and Crowley worked really, really well. It was beautifully cast, and it was the ultimate bromance in the proper way, not in a queerbaity way, but in a proper bromancey way.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say it was bromance. I'd say it was romance. It was full on romance.
Yeah, it was a definite romantic friendship. And I've heard people complain that, oh yeah, but you know, there was no sexual content, and that kind of wasn't really the point of the book or the series.
Yeah,
but when asked,
to be honest, yeah.
Yeah, but when asked, the producers and Neil Gaiman have both said, yeah, they're totally into each other. They are in love, you know?
I mean, even Michael Sheen himself, the guy who plays Aziraphale, says, oh yes, he's in love with Crowley, which is quite easy, because loving David Tennant is quite easy.
Yeah.
He stares at him adoringly, like, I mean, how much more do you want than than Crowley shouting, you know, and then going and crying, and as he's exiting the burning bookshop saying, find me somebody to love, like, come on.
Yeah, and then at the end when they're toasting each other in the Ritz, and Aziraphale looking at him like the entire world existing just so that Crowley can walk on it, and saying, yeah, you know, to the world. It's like, no, that's so obvious. It doesn't always have to be like a massive snogging scene.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't think either of them know how to like, if they're an angel and a demon, I don't think that kind of love is even anything that would occur to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's the whole dogma thing, isn't it, where let's say they lack a bit of definition in certain areas.
Yeah.
Obviously Good Omens has attracted an awful lot of criticism, both from certain, well, you know, from Christian groups, because they feel their religion is being mocked. Which, let's be honest, in some ways it is being gently mocked, but it's been so gently mocked by Good Omens that I think it's saying, actually, there's lots of good here as well. Religions, organised religions, are about ethics, not morality, in the terms that we explained earlier. So they're about imposing a set of standards on a general populace, on their followers, and that may be good, or it may be less good, depending. And quite often, organised religions do not align up with personal morality. To be honest, if you're not writing something that offends a few people, you're probably doing something a bit wrong. I'm not saying you should set out to offend people, but if you're going to talk about huge subjects like good and evil, and coming to and you know, the wall between the two and coming together in the middle, then yeah, you are going to upset some people. I think that certain Christian groups didn't really like the quite gay depiction of the two main characters as well.
Yeah, I think that probably a lot of people got annoyed with that. They also got annoyed with the idea of, you know, a demon being even a little bit friendly.
Yeah, and saying it's mainstreaming Satanism, which to me is one of the most ludicrous statements, because Satanism is just a branch of Christianity. It's Christianity in reverse. So yeah, to say that is ridiculous, because Crowley is about as far as you can get away from Satanism.
Yeah.
This is people who genuinely do not understand what they're talking about, so you can't even get into an argument with them because they don't have the tools for it.
Also, I imagine a lot of people who've complained about it didn't actually read it.
Yeah, or properly watch it.
Yeah.
It was a bit amusing that there was a petition. Sorry.
Yeah. So there was a petition recently. You guys may have seen this. There was a petition made to Netflix to remove Amazon Prime's Good Omens. Yes, that's right. And you know for sure that the people who are petitioning it didn't watch it. But yeah, they said they wanted Netflix to cancel Good Omens, even though it was for Amazon Prime. And thousands of people signed this. Thousands of people. Now, many of them will have been Christians who disagreed with Good Omens for all of the reasons we've said before. Some of those people were angry, actually, because they said it endorsed creationism.
Yeah, which is, again, I really think Good Omens is something that goes over a lot of people's heads. And I realise that my intellectual snobbery is showing a bit here, but genuinely I do think some people just don't understand it. And that's okay. Maybe it's not really for them.
Yeah.
But if you can seriously watch it and say, oh no, it endorses Satanism, or you know, it's anti-Christian, or if it endorses creationism, then you must have either gone out of the way to miss the point, or it's completely gone over your head.
Yeah. And I think the final one of why some people have definitely given it a thumbs down or given it a low one, and I've actually seen genuinely complaining about this, is that there are a whole bunch of people who thought that it was too social justice warrior, in that they got annoyed by the fact that God was voiced by a woman.
Yeah.
And that Adam and Eve were black. They were like, oh, you don't need to shove it down my throat. And
even though, you know, I love it, because these people are kind of the ones who would say scientifically, and without really understanding science or biology or evolution, and the fact that we all came from Africa. What did they think, we sprang out of Africa with really, really white skin and blonde hair? Because that didn't happen.
Nope.
So, and also, we're talking about a piece of fantasy that's based on a myth that is to do with the evolution of human consciousness. It's not even supposed to be read literally like some Christian groups do. It's a big, big knot, and it's one that I'm kind of like, I kind of just want them to leave them in a tangle over it, because I haven't got the spoons to unpick it for them. It's like, no, you're not worth the effort. You're really not.
And weirdly enough, those kinds of people sort of end up kind of representing the same sort of groups who actually exist in Good Omens.
Yeah, maybe deep down that's what the real problem is. The real problem is that the people who sort of would sign this sort of petition actually really belong to one of the extreme groups on either side, and don't like the fact that the truth cuts a little close to the bone there.
Yeah.
And that morality can be ambiguous and grey.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, and I think this is the bit that I kind of liked, is at the end, Crowley says, you know, we'll be left alone until the big one. And Aziraphale goes, I thought that was the big one. And he goes, no, us versus them.
Yeah.
And it's suddenly this idea that actually the real war that is coming is going to be the extremes against the neutral.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. The humans against the angels and the fallen angels.
Which I think is a fantastic metaphor for any sort of extremism on either side. And actually, that's what ultimately the main battle is again.
Yeah, definitely. Something that has just occurred to me that we probably should talk about since we're talking about Good Omens is we should talk about the depiction of the Antichrist, because that was a huge morality thing right in the middle of this entire series and the book. The idea that been predicted any number of times and the year keeps changing as the year goes by and nobody shows up, to say that there will come the great destroyer, the Antichrist, the son of the devil. Who will bear the number of the beast, blah blah blah. It's all very poetic, and again, it's from the Book of Revelations. What's been done so beautifully in Good Omens is that there was a little bit of a cock up, shall we say, at at the hospital, this very specialized Church of Satan hospital, and the Antichrist, instead of going to the parents who would nurture him in the direction that his nature would incline him, he went to some perfectly ordinary parents instead. And lived the most idyllic childhood imaginable. Partly because he was making it happen and didn't realize it.
Oh, that's a line I really like, where they basically say, "There's a place which has had perfect season, perfect weather for each season."
Yes, perfect snow at Christmas and perfect sunshine in July.
Perfect crisp autumns.
Yeah, and it's a really, really intelligent and fun poke at this idea that nature can be overcome by nurture. And yeah, even the Antichrist, he might have a bad day, and when he has a bad day, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I forgot for a moment that I shouldn't overpower all my friends and try and force them. Yeah, it was just really, really well done, because instead of being nurtured towards this great and terrible destiny, he was just a case of, no, you're an ordinary kid, you go off across the fields with your friends, and it's that ultimately gives him the wherewithal to make a choice, and that's what morality is ultimately, is a choice. Even if your choice is whether the
Absolutely.
world ends or not.
Which is quite a choice to make.
Yes. Before we're canvassing this quite thoroughly, I just want to talk about a couple of other things for comparison. And one of them is another one that attracted an awful lot of criticism, so much so that when the initial film was made, because it wasn't quite, should we say, it wasn't quite lucrative enough to stand up in the face of all the criticism, so the subsequent films weren't made. And that's His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Now, thankfully, a proper version of it is being done by the BBC, and from what I've seen so far, it looks awesome. Philip Pullman's a well-known atheist, and he's quite open about this. And that's fine. That's up to him. And his books reflect that. They're a series of intricate and multi-layered children's books that are really, really very clever. And again, they deconstruct the creation myth, and they deconstruct the idea of God and the devil and heaven and hell, etc., following the adventures of Lyra Belacqua, who is, I would say, she's chaotic good. She has no respect for law or order whatsoever, but her intentions are generally good. She lies almost like it's an art form. And that's how she gets around and gets what she wants. But she does it because she has a strong sense of right and wrong within herself, and generally what she does is right, even when she's made mistakes, particularly after she finds Will, who acts as quite a good foil for her, so that she doesn't just do things rashly on impulse. She starts thinking things through a lot more. And it's very interesting that you have these two basically quite innocent children who are sort of stomping through everything and tearing down all the barriers and changing the universe.
And they are literally doing that.
But that there is a quite an anti-organized religious message in there, or at least one which calls on its readers to really question ethical systems, even if they're morality is aligned with them, to question whether or not you actually need an ethical system, and whether you should be following one that is very concerned with lining its own pockets with wealth and influence and power, and is quite happy to do terrible things, including mutilate children.
Yes.
And also there are angels in there too. And some of the greatest characters actually are the angels. There are angels and witches. So he really couldn't have cocked a snook any more thoroughly at the religious establishment with those books.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, and I don't want to talk too much about this one, but I think it is worth mentioning, if only because this is also a character created by Neil Gaiman. I want to mention the TV show Lucifer.
Yeah.
Gaiman is very good at this. Gaiman is very good at getting people to petition him to stop. A lot of people were incredibly angry at the concept of Lucifer and it being made as a TV show, and that, you know, they said that they're portraying the devil. And it made a really interesting point, which kind of does tie in, you know, with what we were saying earlier about Paradise Lost, but also more importantly ties in with those extreme ideas, those extremes of morality, which is that this version of Lucifer, yes, he was the king of hell, but it was a job. He was sent down there as punishment. And it opens up this really, really interesting line of inquiry whereby we say, if the demons and the devil are punishing wrongdoers, are they not therefore operating within this system?
Yeah.
So how can they represent the opposite of the system if they are actually functioning within it? And this was the point that I was making earlier in terms of Paradise Lost actually highlighting this issue of saying, actually, this isn't a one or the other. This is all one very large system, which is all tied in together. Yeah. And I think that that does come through in Good Omens, in the sense that heaven and hell, they're ready for this battle, but they're organized together. Yeah. They're like, all right, hell's gonna do this. Like it's they're in cahoots. They both want the same thing.
It's really noticeable when they're about to completely throw down, and Aziraphale and Crowley say, well, hang on a minute, have you checked? Are you absolutely sure this is the plan? And like, oh, hang on a minute, we need to speak to head office. Both of them are kind of like, we need to speak to head office.
Yeah, and I like that. Well, I hope someone tells your father, young man. Oh, don't worry, they will. Like, they were on the same side. They were even standing next to each other.
Yeah.
You know, they've got ambassadors. They were operating together to create this outcome. Yeah. Which I think is, yeah, it's really interesting.
So, once again, lawful good and chaotic bad are pretty much... they're not the same thing, but they're definitely different sides of the same coin, and they are as bad as each other, or can be.
Absolutely. Yeah, at extremes. But it's the question of, are they actually chaotic bad, or actually were they lawful bad, because they were still functioning within that structure, which was put in place, even though they were functioning on the other end of the, you know, of the scale. They were following those rules.
Yeah, or perhaps there isn't a greater system on the outside of that, and that is basically God's plan.
Yeah.
Because it was a bit convenient that the stupid midwife was on duty that particular night and mixed up three babies.
It's ineffable.
Exactly. I just want to... there's a couple I do want to mention. There's the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy by Lainey Taylor. Lainey Taylor writes beautiful... intricate fantasy worlds, and it's amazing lyrical prose, and I would say for some people it probably takes a bit of getting into, but the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy works on the premise that an angel and a devil fell in love. Except right. that ultimately, then it's not quite that simple. The angels live on their own plane, and they are basically people with fiery wings, and they're brought up by the highest, the arbitrator, as it were. The female angels are kind of taken away and impregnated, so they'll give birth to soldiers for the army of the righteous, who mm-hmm. can be male or female. And you find out later that what they're really fighting are these creatures that some people call demons, but are actually chimera. And they're just naturally a mixture of sort of human and animal characteristics, and they all exist in different species. And this is a genocidal war that rages across dimensions.
Right.
right up until Karu, who is one of the... Karu, who's one of the Chimera, she finds an injured angel after one of the wars. She's not allowed to fight because she's part of a very endangered species. But she finds this injured angel, and very much has happened during the First World War for humans. Instead of saying, oh, you know, we've got a live one over here, come over here and finish him off, she actually saves his life. She does something that stops him bleeding to death until his own people come and collect him. And he remembers, so he goes looking for her, and it all just goes horribly Romeo and Juliet from there. And they're really, really interesting, but again, it takes religious imagery and turns it completely on its head. They're well worth looking at, and I think they do cover many of the same sort of things that we've been talking about with Good Omens. The other thing, which is definitely lighter in many ways, is The Good Place, which is a series on Netflix.
Yeah.
Which I don't want to spoilify, but that really does delve into the whole what is ethics, what is morality, what is free will, what is heaven and what is hell. And it's basically four people die and they find themselves in heaven. And they know that all four of them know that they really shouldn't be there. They're certain they shouldn't be there, but they don't want to go to the bad place. So
no.
Thus starts a hilarious romp whereby they attempt to deceive the keepers of the good place that they do in fact belong there. And as I said, I won't spoilify it because I think people should go and watch it.
Yeah.
I'm chuckling inside because I know what happens.
It's a recipe for disaster, but yeah.
Yes.
The interesting thing about The Good Place, and this isn't too much of a spoiler, is the fact that The Good Place kind of starts off as this relatively jokey kind of series, and then actually it's basically saying that there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, is the kind of the message. Whereby they're kind of looking at how things are calculated.
Yeah.
And they say, actually, so here you are, this man hours for his mother. And you're like, oh, that should be counted as a good thing. Yes, except the problem is that he bought flowers from a person who was... He works in a job where they're associated with sweatshops. He bought flowers from something which used pesticides, which was causing this, that, and the other. So actually, he actually committed more bad than he did good in buying this. And I really like that because it does kind of, again, look, it's playing with that concept of the system.
Yeah.
And what is good and what is bad.
Yeah, it's the idea that you actually cannot quantify morality or good deeds or good acts or whatever in any meaningful way because I once heard it said that it would be easy for anybody to be a perfect saint if they lived in utter isolation and never had any contact with anybody else. But they also wouldn't know yeah. or learn or expand or become anything because the point is not to be a perfect saint. The point is to be a person who makes mistakes and messes up and occasionally does bad things in order to grow and become something more. And if you go into then the more pagan tradition, the idea that we're all actually connected to each other and that the point is, in fact, to go out and mess up, but do the least amount of harm you possibly can do. There's no question that you will do harm, but the idea is to choose the path that does the least amount of harm. And then ultimately we all go back to being part of this great consciousness that is the universe.
Yeah.
enriched with experiences. So what you'd actually be doing wrong would be living in a cave as a hermit, because that's a very limiting experience.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we've kind of come to the end of our episode on depictions of morality in speculative fiction.
I think we have. Before we go, I kind of do just want to just hear sort of your impression of Good Omens, the series versus the book.
I'll admit I was wary, but I went in thinking, well, it's been cast really well. And I do still think it was cast really well. I think it was probably one of the best adaptations, having heard radio adaptations and things that were very good, of the book. And I think it was true to the spirit, even when it changed things, except in the case of Anathema.
Yes, thank you. Okay, I am so glad that someone else thought that as well.
I didn't.
Now I'm just going to.
I didn't object to her being like basically POC or anything like that. That was great. But why had she been a rich American? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, that bit really annoyed me. And again, it was nothing to do with skin colour or culture or anything like that. Like, she could have been a European, she could have been Polish, she could have been black British as well. Like, we have a lot of people of various different ethnicities and skin colour who are British. I just wanted her to be English. I wanted her to be British. I wanted her to be that little British witch that you almost do know. That was the character that I really loved, and I didn't understand why she'd become this and this American new age woman as well. And I'm not going to say this has nothing to do with the actress. The actress did an amazing job.
Yeah, she was brilliant.
She was great. She was fantastic. I didn't like that cast. Not the casting choice, but I didn't like that decision for her character. I think they probably did that so that they could appeal to an American audience as well. But for me, she felt very alien, and she didn't feel like she fit within that tiny little English countryside narrative at all.
That didn't work for me either. And that's the one thing that I think felt forced.
Yeah.
Despite the brilliant job the actress did, that part of the story.
Yeah. That being said, I really liked the casting for Gabriel.
Oh, John Hamm was great. I was fine with that. That didn't bother me at all. That wasn't forced.
10 out of 10. Yeah, that wasn't forced at all. 10 out of 10. That was fantastic. And as I said, all of the actors did a brilliant, brilliant job. And I really did think that David Tennant and Michael Sheen made a fantastic Crowley and Aziraphale. I always pronounced it as Crowley, though, but they kept saying Crowley.
I would say Crowley because you think Aleister Crowley.
Yeah,
that was kind of the point. But maybe that's like American pronunciation coming in as well. What I liked about Gabriel was the fact that John Hamm brought a real sort of almost used car salesman type glint to the character.
Yeah, he really did.
But all sort of like the slightly too polished upper management or business owner type feel. It was great. Anna Maxwell Martin did a really good job as Beelzebub as well. Interesting choice, that, definitely.
No, I think it was brilliant. It was very, very well done. It was very good. Congratulations to all of them. I just enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so on that note, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and Madeline has one this week, hopefully.
And a series called Fruits Basket. Now, Fruits Basket...
you cut out right at the beginning of that. Could you just go back to the beginning? Sure.
I do have one for you, and this one is a little bit unusual. I'm going to recommend a series called Fruits Basket. Now, Fruits Basket is actually quite an old manga now. I read it when I was quite young, still in school, became very, very addicted to it. It's a kind of a supernatural family friendship drama. Way back when, they did do a short anime series about it, but it was an adapted only 26 episodes or so, and it didn't really follow the entirety of the manga, which became a lot darker. Now recently they have started to they've rebooted it, so they're doing a new anime series based on the manga, which is going to follow the whole story and has already gotten darker. And the animation is beautiful. And the first few episodes feel a little bit of, mostly because they're covering ground which has been covered in previous series and that a lot of people are already familiar with. But it's definitely still very enjoyable, definitely worth watching if you don't feel up to reading the whole series. As a general premise, it follows the story of a girl named Toru. And Toru recently lost her mother, and her father died when she was young. And because she isn't able to go and live with her grandfather just yet because he's having renovations, she's been living in a tent in the forest.
Okay.
For a few weeks now. She's a very resourceful girl. Toru as a character is very optimistic. She likes looking on the bright side of things despite all of the the horrors that have been inflicted on her in her life. She's very hardworking. She's very, you know, one step forward kind of person. And she happens to come across a mysterious house in the forest where she realizes that one of her classmates lives, and this classmate is named Yuki. And Yuki is very aloof. He seems very cool. He's very popular in school, but he's a little bit strange. And next thing you know, she basically starts living in the house with them because they discover that she's living in a tent, and then the tent gets caught in a landslide. And his cousin, who he lives with, Shigure, basically says, yeah, why don't you just come live in our house and you can live there for free as long as you clean and cook and clean. So that's what she does. And she discovers that there is a curse on this family. Now, here's the bit that's weird. It's this curse, which means that certain members of the family, if they're hugged by the opposite sex, turn into animals from the zodiac, from the Chinese zodiac.
Right, okay. That's very different.
It is, it's very different. And so, yeah, she suddenly discovers that Yuki is a rat. Shigure is a dog, but weirdly enough, there is another boy named Kyo who is a cat. And cats don't exist in the Chinese zodiac, except for in the folklore where the cat got tricked out of the banquet. Yes. And thus they start this whole kind of exploration of this incredibly dark family drama. You're suddenly like, oh, it's all lighthearted. And then it's like, no, we're talking about like mental and physical trauma that's happened in this family because they're all cursed. So it's actually very good. It's well worth watching. It's quite sweet. So I really, really do recommend it. You can watch the first few episodes on Crunchyroll, or you can read the manga, which is finished. So that's Fruits Basket. That's my recommendation for the week.
That title really doesn't hint at the delights contained within, does it?
No, it doesn't, but trust me, it's good. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks, goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.